Welcome. This is the New England Journal of Medicine. I'm Dr. Lisa Johnson. This week, September 18, 2025, we talk about PI3K altered colorectal cancer, type 2 diabetes, oral semaglutide, and proportional assist ventilation, a review article on tumor lysis syndrome, a case report of a girl with chest pain and bone and liver lesions, and perspectives on integrating pharmacotherapy into tobacco control, on Medicaid enrollees with chronic conditions, and on ultra-processed food. Low-dose aspirin for PI3K-altered localized colorectal cancer by Anna Martling from the Karolinska Institutet, Stockholm, and co-authors. Aspirin reduces the incidence of colorectal adenoma and colorectal cancer among high-risk persons. Observational studies suggest that aspirin may also improve disease-free survival after a diagnosis of cancer of the gastrointestinal tract, particularly among patients with tumors harboring somatic PIK3CA mutations. However, data from randomized trials have been lacking. In this randomized trial, 626 patients with stage 1, 2, or 3 rectal cancer or stage 2 or 3 colon cancer who had undergone radical resection of the primary tumor and had somatic alterations in PI3K pathway genes were assigned to receive 160 milligrams of aspirin or matched placebo once daily for 3 years. Aspirin was associated with a significantly lower incidence of colorectal cancer recurrence than placebo among patients with PIK3CA hotspot mutations in exon 9 or 20 and appeared to have a similar benefit among those with other somatic alterations in PI3K pathway genes. In an editorial, Richard Goldberg from the West Virginia University Cancer Institute, Morgantown, and Jeffrey Meyerhart from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Boston, write that the analgesic, antipyretic, and anti-inflammatory properties of aspirin have been known for centuries. Taken together, the results by Martling and co-authors and those of previous trials establish a new standard of care in which testing for mutations in PIK3CA and related genes is conducted soon after diagnosis, and inexpensive, risk-adapted aspirin therapy is prescribed soon after surgery in patients whose tumors have the relevant mutations. The relevance of biomarker-based selection of adjuvant therapy in colorectal cancer reinforces the recommendation for universal molecular testing of tumors at diagnosis. Orforglipron, an oral small-molecule GLP-1 receptor agonist in early type 2 diabetes, by Julio Rosenstock, from the Velocity Clinical Research Center at Medical City, Dallas, and co-authors. Orforglipron is a small-molecule, non-peptide, glucagon-like peptide 1, GLP-1, receptor agonist in clinical development for type 2 diabetes and weight management. In this phase 3 trial, 559 participants with early type 2 diabetes not controlled with diet and exercise alone were randomly assigned to receive once daily orforglipron at one of three doses, or placebo, for 40 weeks. Significant and clinically meaningful reductions in the glycated hemoglobin level were observed with all three doses of orforglipron. The changes were significantly greater than those with placebo. The most common adverse events were mild to moderate gastrointestinal events, most of which occurred during dose escalation. Derek Lowe from the American Association for the Advancement of Science, Washington, D.C., writes in an editorial that orforglipron led to improvement in glycemic control, similar to results seen in trials of other GLP-1 agonists, accompanied by major weight loss. The gastrointestinal side effects were those expected with GLP-1 agonists as well. All in all, orforglipron appears to mimic GLP-1 and the synthetic peptidic GLP-1 agonists at the structural biology level all the way up to the level of clinical results in patients. The trial by Rosenstock and colleagues did not appear to show noticeable hepatotoxicity, a feature that has stopped the development of other small molecule GLP-1 drug candidates, such as danuglipron. Oral semaglutide at a dose of 25 milligrams in adults with overweight or obesity, by Sean Wharton from the University of Toronto, Canada, and co-authors. Oral semaglutide at a dose of 25 milligrams may provide an alternative treatment option to injectable semaglutide, 2.4 milligrams, and higher dose oral semaglutide, 50 milligrams, for persons with overweight or obesity. In this 71-week trial conducted at 22 sites in 4 countries, 307 persons without diabetes who had a body mass index of 30 or higher, or a body mass index of 27 or higher with at least one weight-related complication, were randomly assigned in a 2-to-1 ratio to receive oral semaglutide at a dose of 25 milligrams or placebo once daily plus lifestyle interventions. Oral semaglutide resulted in substantial weight loss with a safety profile consistent with that of the GLP-1 agonist class of medications. Proportional assist ventilation for minimizing the duration of mechanical ventilation, by Karen Bosma from the University of Western Ontario, London, Canada, and co-authors. In critically ill patients, tapering and discontinuing mechanical ventilation as soon as is feasible is important in order to reduce the risk of complications and to improve long-term outcomes. This study evaluated whether the use of proportional assist ventilation with load-adjustable gain factors, PAV+, results in a shorter time to successful liberation from mechanical ventilation than pressure support ventilation, PSV. 573 adult patients who had been receiving mechanical ventilation for at least 24 hours and were able to undergo partial ventilatory support with PSV, but were not yet ready for stopping ventilation, were randomly assigned to undergo PAV+, which targeted normal work of breathing, or PSV, which targeted a normal respiratory rate and tidal volume. This multicenter trial showed that PAV+ did not lead to a shorter time to successful discontinuation of ventilation than PSV when each method was introduced as patients were first able to receive partial ventilatory support.
I'm Darren Teichman, a deputy editor at the New England Journal of Medicine. I've been a full-time medical journal editor for over 15 years, but I've never stopped seeing patients. Just like the other full-time physician editors on our team, I continue to practice medicine for a couple of reasons. Most importantly, I love it. It's who I am. It's who I trained to be. I've known many of my patients for over 20 years, and I don't want to lose those connections. I also think seeing patients makes me a better editor. When we sit around the table and discuss papers, my colleagues and I can understand why the questions asked by the research studies we're considering are important or not to practicing clinicians because we see patients ourselves. I love this work because I always learn a lot. And the goal is simple: to help our authors clearly, honestly, and concisely communicate their findings to our readers so they, in turn, can use what they read to help their patients. It certainly helps me take better care of my patients. We're published by the Massachusetts Medical Society, a not-for-profit publisher, and we rely on subscriptions from individual readers, medical schools, and libraries to fund what we do.
Tumor lysis syndrome, a review article by R. Gregory Bocek and Matthew Lunning from the University of Nebraska Medical Center and Nebraska Medicine, Omaha. tumor lysis syndrome may be induced during cancer treatment when the rapid destruction of malignant cells and the attendant massive release of their intracellular contents, including nucleic acids, results in a pathophysiological state that overwhelms the ability of the body to maintain electrolyte uric acid homeostasis. The syndrome has long been characterized by severe hyperuricemia, and thus treating elevated uric acid levels has been the main focus of treatment, which leads to marked acute kidney injury and systemic derangements. However, the epidemiology of tumor lysis syndrome is changing with the introduction of newer therapies for cancer. Tumor lysis syndrome is becoming less predictable and increasingly important in the care of patients with cancer. With the availability of rasburicase, which powerfully lowers uric acid levels, hyperphosphatemia has replaced hyperuricemia as the main nephrotoxin of importance in tumor lysis. Careful attention to fluid management and prevention of volume overload may diminish the risk of in-hospital death. In patients with acute leukemias or aggressive lymphomas, cytoreduction before the initiation of disease-specific induction therapy may reduce the incidence and severity of subsequent tumor lysis. The authors review the epidemiology and pathophysiology of tumor lysis syndrome, risk factors, prophylaxis, and treatment, and the evolution of the syndrome that has coincided with a continually expanding list of new therapies. An 11-year-old girl with chest pain and bone and liver lesions. A case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Lindsay Pindyke Carter and colleagues. An 11-year-old girl presented with a week's history of nausea, vomiting, and colicky abdominal pain, followed by atraumatic pain in the right arm, shoulder, and sternum. The pain progressed despite resolution of gastrointestinal symptoms and was accompanied by discomfort with deep breaths. The patient's medical history was notable for eczema, as well as recurrent skin and soft tissue infections due to methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. On current examination, the patient was afebrile and well-appearing, but had localized tenderness in the right arm and chest. Imaging revealed multifocal bone lesions involving the humerus and sternum, as well as multiple hypoechoic and T2 hyperintense lesions in the liver and spleen. Laboratory studies showed elevated inflammatory markers, anemia, and hypoalbuminemia. Her social history revealed that her family had recently adopted a kitten, her only animal exposure. This epidemiologic link, together with her bone and hepatic findings, pointed toward disseminated Bartonella henselae infection, cat scratch disease, as the diagnosis. Reducing Tobacco Use Worldwide, a New Perspective Series, an editorial by Nancy Rigotti from Massachusetts General Hospital, Boston, and co-authors. Tobacco use kills more than 7 million people worldwide each year, including 1.3 million who die from the effects of exposure to secondhand smoke. As a major contributor to cancer, cardiovascular diseases, and chronic respiratory diseases, tobacco use puts an enormous strain on healthcare systems and undermines economic productivity. But tobacco-related harm is preventable. To explore the best ways of addressing this modifiable driver of global disease burden, in this issue, the journal is launching a perspective series entitled Reducing Tobacco Use Worldwide. The series will critically evaluate strategies for reducing global tobacco consumption, with an emphasis on specific challenges and opportunities in low- and middle-income countries. The topics to be covered align with the World Health Organization's pillars of tobacco cessation, which include behavioral support, pharmacotherapy, digital technology, and healthcare systems. We hope that readers will come away from this monthly series with a better understanding of the contextual challenges and potential solutions for curbing the global epidemic of tobacco-related illness. Integrating pharmacotherapy into tobacco control in low- and middle-income countries, a critical need. A perspective on reducing tobacco use worldwide by Nancy Rigotti from the Massachusetts General Hospital, Boston, and co-authors. The global burden of tobacco use is borne disproportionately by low- and middle-income countries, which are home to approximately 80% of the 1.3 billion people worldwide who use tobacco. Up to half of people who don't stop using tobacco die prematurely from tobacco-related disease, whereas those who quit have a substantially reduced risk of tobacco-associated premature death. Robust evidence has shown the effectiveness of tobacco cessation treatments consisting of behavioral support, pharmacotherapy, or both. Behavioral treatment alone is effective, but combining it with pharmacotherapy is associated with higher abstinence rates, especially among people who are heavily dependent on nicotine. Substantially reducing the burden of tobacco-related mortality in low- and middle-income countries will require tobacco cessation treatment that includes both pharmacotherapy and behavioral interventions. Pharmacotherapy needs to be affordable, readily available for all tobacco users, and incorporated into national health systems and universal health coverage frameworks. Solving the challenges associated with medication costs, regulatory and supply chain barriers, and the public's unfamiliarity with pharmacotherapy is essential. Protecting Medicaid enrollees with chronic conditions amid work requirements. A perspective by John Ayanian from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. As a key part of the recent U.S. Budget Reconciliation Act, officially titled the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, OBBBA, that was signed by President Donald Trump on July 4th of this year, Congress required states that have expanded Medicaid to adults younger than 65 years of age with incomes up to 138% of the federal poverty level to verify every 6 months that those enrollees are engaged in employment, community service, or educational programs for at least 80 hours per month to maintain their Medicaid coverage. 40 states and the District of Columbia, which had expanded Medicaid to a total of approximately 20.3 million adults as of June 2024, will be subject to this policy. The OBBBA specifies a number of exemptions that new Medicaid applicants and current enrollees can claim in order to be excluded from work requirements. See the box published with this article. The requirements will take effect in January 2027. State Medicaid programs have 18 months to develop administrative systems for implementing these requirements. They will need to provide clear guidance to clinicians for documenting the reasons that certain patients should be exempted from Medicaid work requirements, offering clinicians some discretion, and to establish streamlined and responsive processes for submitting required documentation. This planned implementation of Medicaid work requirements in many states in early 2027 provides an important opportunity to obtain longitudinal observational data to guide federal and state Medicaid policy. Ultra-processed food on an ultra-fast track. A perspective by David Ludwig from Boston Children's Hospital. Food processing has generally been considered to be a technological asset used to enhance the taste, nutritional value, shelf life, transportability, and safety of dietary staples. Yet, with the advent of modern industrial practices, processing has also acquired negative connotations, and recently, concerns about ultra-processed food, UPF, have become widespread. Observational research has linked consumption of UPF to a wide range of chronic conditions, including obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, cancer, and behavioral disorders. The NOVA food classification system has advanced efforts to address modern diets of highly processed foods. But concerns about NOVA's practicality and robustness have been noted repeatedly in the scientific literature. Evidence related to UPF consumption derives nearly exclusively from only observational studies, which have a high risk of bias because of confounding and misclassification, and cannot prove causation. Few randomized controlled trials of UPF consumption have been conducted, and none have assessed long-term outcomes. Pending actionable experimental data, it would be prudent to focus nutrition policy reform on the processed foods for which there is already strong scientific evidence of harm. For example, refined grains, added sugar, and other highly processed carbohydrates. In our images in clinical medicine, subcutaneous paniculitis-like T-cell lymphoma is shown. A 30-year-old woman presented with a 10-week history of painful skin nodules and a 6-week history of fevers and night sweats. A physical examination was notable for palpable subcutaneous nodules with overlying erythema. Another image shows primary varicella infection. A previously healthy 44-year-old man presented with a 4-day history of itchy rash and a 2-day history of fever and malaise. A pleomorphic eruption of papules and pustules of different sizes and stages of evolution was noted. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.